I'm Bert Broadhead, and welcome to Building Our Future, the podcast where we meet the people changing the way we design, construct, and utilise our built environment. Picking up on last week's interview with Vanessa Butts, where we discussed the idea of technology as an enabler for connectivity, today I look at it from the perspective of major infrastructure planning. Can technology help face off the challenges of yesterday, complexity and multiple stakeholders, and turn them into the opportunities of tomorrow? Moreover, what sort of transport should we be planning for? Are autonomous vehicles really what they're being promised to be? Going back to Vanessa's point, should we be thinking more about how we can be using technology and transport to complement our changing needs from the world and workplace, rather than just going where the technology takes us? My guest today is Nathan Corran. Nathan is an architect, transport planner, software engineer, and entrepreneur. Having worked for many years as an architect specialising in sustainable transit-orientated developments, Nathan became interested in how new transportation technologies could positively influence urban design. This led him to work on the planning and design stages of urban-scale automated transit networks. More recently, he has founded Pedaris, an online collaborative planning and design platform for urban infrastructure. Nathan, welcome to the podcast.
Great to be here.
Well, thank you for coming on. Please maybe start by you just explaining what is Pedaris and more importantly, why did the need come about?
Pedaris is a digital platform for collaborative urban infrastructure planning, mostly focused on transport planning at this point. What this means is that it's basically a whiteboard, an electronic whiteboard. It lives in your browser. It lives on the cloud. And it allows you to build up urban infrastructure models and share those models in real time with other people. And those other people might be transport planners or civil engineers or policymakers or key stakeholders. But by sharing these models in real time, you're able to get immediate feedback on them from many different disciplines and stakeholders. And that basically allows for much more inclusive planning practices, which are also much more accurate and much faster. It basically solves the problem that a lot of planners have faced, where they need to bring in many more people into the process, but they also need the process to be faster and cheaper, and generally bringing in more people just slows everything down. I think through digital collaboration tools like Pedaris, that paradox can be solved. We can bring in a lot more people and still be faster and cheaper and ultimately design better cities.
When we talk about infrastructure projects, transport led infrastructure projects, are you talking kind of road upgrades, or is this what scale are we talking about?
So it could be road upgrades. We started with fixed infrastructure public transport systems. So that is trains, metros, trams, also the automated transport systems that I initially started my transport planning career with. We're moving into more generalized forms of transport, including buses, cars, autonomous taxis, etc., so that it will be fully multimodal by the end of this year.
Most of us listening to this will have had some experience of planning, possibly on a much smaller scale, whether it's on our homes or what have you, and we'll know that it can be sticky at the best of times. But so what you're talking about is much more complex schemes where you need first the planning and the buy-in as to how it fits in within the wider planning fabric and also the wider infrastructure fabric. Secondly, you need to know that it's actually deliverable. So the engineers all need to be able to talk the same language as the planners. And thirdly, I suppose you need buy-in from the public and the local community and other interested groups.
That's correct. The thing about infrastructure planning at urban scales is that it involves a lot of different disciplines and a lot of different jurisdictions, and all of them need to get into alignment with each other in order to deliver a project. One of the really striking things when you look at the history of, say, transport infrastructure is how much worse we've gotten at delivering it over the years. So if you go back to Victorian times, for example, the first modern railway was built in 1830. And by 1852, most of the railways that now exist in the UK had been built. So that was most of the national rail network built in under 22 years, approaching two centuries ago. Today, we take a project like Crossrail. It's an amazing project, but it's taken 10 years to build, you know, one rail line across a city. And that was actually preceded by 68 years of feasibility studies before breaking ground. So how do, over the course of two centuries, we go from being able to build an entire nation worth of infrastructure in 22 years to, you know, only being able to build a single rail line in 78 years? And the reason that this has gotten so much slower and also so much more expensive is because the number of experts involved in the process has exponentiated. There's many more people that you need to get involved. So, you know, back in Isambard Kingdom Brunel's day, there weren't that many layers of management between him and the bricklayers on the Great Western Railway. Now there are. There's a lot of different expertise in there. There's a lot of different regulations. Moreover, society is much more democratic. You can't just have a bunch of people in the way of what you want to do and just sort of shoo them out of the way. You actually have to work with them. You have to deliver something that's mutually beneficial to them, or you have to figure out how to buy them out if necessary. And so this increasing technical complexity and increasing democracy, essentially, means that these projects have just gotten orders of magnitude harder and slower and more expensive than they used to be. But I do think that, as I say, digital collaboration tools can solve this problem. And the reason I think this, by the way, is in some of my former ventures in the software world, I got a lot of exposure to agile software engineering. And this is the process where sometimes hundreds of thousands of collaborators can come together in a highly technical exercise to build something like the Linux kernel, which probably powers your phone and your servers and almost everything you do. That involved the fluid collaboration of about 400,000 individuals with almost no central governance. And the way they do that is by having these tools that allow everybody to see what everybody else is doing and provide feedback and validation on that in a very rapid fashion. And so I thought, let's take these tools and techniques, which have allowed for tremendous innovation in the software world, and let's bring that to the process of designing cities.
So what you've ended up with is a platform by which you're introducing consistency to the process so that the planners and the engineers and all the stakeholders are operating off the same model rather than all using their own independent models and arguing over which one's which and having a massive time delay while you try and compare apples and oranges.
Exactly. There's a single source of truth that everybody can reference. That said, we're kind of taking some shortcuts to get there. So this single source of truth that everybody uses has been an objective of the BIM industry for a long time. BIM level 4, I think they call it. And the problem with doing this is if you want a single model that works for your regional planners and your structural engineers and your transport economists and everybody else, then that model has to be enormously complex. And delivering a model of that kind of complexity with the ability to interoperate with all the different disciplines that need to interact with that model is going to be a gigantic effort to deliver. There's a roadmap that the BIM industry has for getting there, but it's probably 10 years off before that's possible. We're actually taking kind of a different approach. We think that it's necessary to synchronize everyone, but only on certain key pieces of data. So the nuts and bolts on your trust bridge don't need to live in the model that the regional planner is using.
Right.
The demographics that the transport economist is using don't need to live in the model that the civil engineer is using. So what we do is we actually go for the sparsest model that we can. We hold just the data that everybody needs to agree on in our model, and then we keep just that data synchronized. And we leave a lot of information outside the model on people's desktops in specialized applications because they don't necessarily need to synchronize it.
That's the age-old problem with all IT solutions is where to stop versus the, oh, that would be cool versus the, actually, do we really need that?
Yeah. So, you know, for example, if you're building a rail line, you need to very much agree on the boundaries of that line, the width of what's called the kinematic envelope. And that's basically, you know, if you poke something into the kinematic envelope, your trains are going to scrape against it, and that's bad, right? So that's a piece of information that absolutely everybody needs to agree on. And if that's ever violated, then flashing red lights should go off, and you know you have a problem. And an example of you know what might be a problem for is in France a few years ago, the rail operator ordered 50 million euros. No, I'm sorry, they ordered a much larger number of euros worth of train sets to upgrade the rail system there. But those trains were 4 centimeters too wide for the platforms at hundreds of stations. And that turned into an unexpected 50 million euro expense to modify those platforms. If the train operator and the station operator had been working off a consistent set of data, then that problem wouldn't have occurred. So that data needs to be shared. So basically what we have is we have this parametric model that keeps those key parameters in the cloud. It provides an interface that allows you to interact with this at a fairly high level, just as a 2D planning tool within your browser. And then it provides what are called APIs, so programmatic interfaces that third-party software can use to stay synchronized with that. So that way, you know, if you're a civil engineer working on AutoCAD Civil 3D and planner working in ArcGIS, you can be synchronizing through these APIs with that core data that's in the cloud. And if you tweak something that somebody else needs to know about, then that shows up in their model within about 1.5 seconds.
That is, I suppose, the basis of Podaris, but there are many more pretty exciting looking features you've got on there. So you have immediate travel time plotting, spatial connectivity analysis, and plans for future integration with GIS and predictive simulations. Where does this kind of end? What's the real goal?
The real goal is to provide a tool which lets you start napkin sketching, basically, in a highly collaborative and highly accurate fashion, and then lets you take those napkin sketches forwards with sort of no break of gauge, no loss of information as you do higher fidelity models, as you bring things into detailed engineering, and ultimately as you deliver a project. What we want is for every stage of project development to be directly traceable to the previous stage, so that that first napkin sketch, you know, sets down the parameters that everybody can reference from that point forward. What happens now is as you go from one stage of development to the next, you have to leave the old applications behind and rebuild the model. And inevitably, there's a huge loss of information in that process. A lot of tacit knowledge gets lost as well. So by not having any sort of discontinuities in the planning process, and I think that this will allow projects to go just tremendously faster, but also much more creatively. And this is something that's very important.
And who are you selling the product to? So who, and I suppose that's a two-way question. So also, whose responsibility is it to ensure that there is this real-time collaboration between the stakeholders?
Well, the responsibility at present really would lie with the project manager for transport infrastructure projects, whether that's building a new system from scratch or extending a current system. The customers for this tend to be planning and engineering consultancies, airports, large corporate campuses, other institutions that are managing transport infrastructure planning projects. That said, whose responsibility it is to ensure real-time collaboration is a really tough question, because the answer is, at present, it's nobody's responsibility. The industry has spent the last couple of centuries learning the lesson that the more cooks in the kitchen, the harder things get. And so actually collaboration is something the industry tends to shy away from and actively avoid, if at all possible. And there's a good reason for that. It's because until the cloud came along, until universally compatible web browsers that could run, you know, complex client-side applications came along, you just couldn't do this collaboration. You know, more cooks in the kitchen really did spoil the broth. These digital collaboration tools have changed the equation. And what we're faced with now is actually quite a challenging process of getting the industry to recognize that. There's a big culture change issue here, where we actually need to not just provide cool collaboration tools to the industry and say, hey guys, have fun with this. We need to actually convince the industry that such collaboration will be beneficial to it.
Is there a line, though, at which democratization of these kind of processes can go too far, and ultimately you need a decision maker to say, look, okay, we've heard the opinions, but this is what's happening?
Oh, definitely, definitely. And you know, one of the things about our platform is that it provides sort of a very robust hierarchy of permissions, so that you ultimately do have a decision maker that can decide who gets to do what to a project and so forth.
Going hand in hand with collaboration is the concept of big data, which in some ways is a slightly irritating kind of catch-all buzz phrase, but it's certainly popular at the moment. And in this context, you've got on your projects a huge amount of data entry, data collection, and it's really about A, how that is shared, but also how you can sift through all of the data points and turn it into something meaningful. And when I met you last, you were giving a presentation where you ran through what's known as the data pyramid, which I'll put on our website. It's quite a useful tool of thinking how data moves to wisdom. Would you mind just explaining that process?
Big data is very much a buzzword, but it is something really powerful if you use it right. So how do you use it? Data itself is not useful. It has no meaning at all. Data is just ones and zeros on a hard drive somewhere outside the M25. And so what you need to do is you need to first turn data into information. Information is what happens when data is interpreted by your brain. Ultimately, in order to turn any of this into action, it has to go through a human brain, and that's really important. So turning data into information is a process of mining that data for insights that you, a human being, can understand. But in the context of, you know, urban scale decision making, anything you're doing at cities, the decisions are not made on an individual basis. So having something in your head isn't good enough. You actually need to be able to share that with other people. When you share information with other people and it's understood by other people, at that point it becomes knowledge. So the key component of knowledge is that ability to communicate information. As you start sharing knowledge with other people, you begin to understand what it is that you really know, what it is crucially that you don't know, that's really important to understand, and who else might know that. And as you get a picture of this sort of information of understanding, you start to develop wisdom. So this is the framework. It's data, it's this DIKW pyramid: data, information, knowledge, wisdom.
We're in an age where everyone's obsessed with data collection, data mining, and you get phrases like data is the new oil and all the cliches, until you can get it to a point where you can interlace one data set with another in an intuitive way to create information. It's kind of redundant, but it's interesting to keep that at the forefront of everyone's mind when we're talking about data.
If I can, I'd like to share a billion-pound idea that I've had, which maybe...
Don't share this.
No, man. this is a freebie to somebody in your audience. I can't actualize this one yet, but maybe somebody can. So as an example of the sort of data that's being generated now, you have cars driving around cities, and they've got cameras on them, they've got LiDAR scanners on them, they're generating enormous amounts of information about the physical environment of cities, you know, the shape of the buildings surrounding the streets, the condition of the roads, the height of the overpasses, etc., right? All of this data is being generated by the cars, and right now it just stays in the cars. What if you could aggregate that? What you could do is you could build up a model of a city in three-dimensional, photographic, high-resolution point cloud data. You could build up this 3D model of the city that would update itself minute by minute, so it was always accurate. As soon as that pothole formed, the next car to drive over it would contribute a 3D model of that pothole to the collective model of the city, right? And so that is, you know, that's what you can do with big data. You can generate this model. But if that model just sits there inaccessible to anyone, that's pointless. That's a pointless exercise, right? How do you make that model accessible to the street maintenance crews? How do you make it accessible to the emergency services that need to see whether they can drive under a bridge, you know, a fire truck under a bridge? How do you make it accessible to the architects who want to put their new building into this beautiful model that's being automatically synthesized, right? That's a collaboration problem, essentially.
That is a classic example where the idea is so clear, and yet the growing tensions between, okay, well, why should I give you my data for free? Who's going to collect that data, and will they profit off it? All sorts of questions to be answered, but the possibilities are almost endless.
Yeah.
So Nathan, now as I've got you here, there aren't too many times one gets to speak to someone with experience as an architect, transport planner, and a software engineer. Your previous job, you were working on a project which, to my shame, I hadn't even heard of, the Heathrow Pod. The Heathrow Pod is a set of autonomous electric-powered pod vehicles at Heathrow Terminal 5, operating on a 3.8-kilometre route, delivering passengers to and from the business car park to the terminal. This has been going since 2011. How have I not heard of this?
Well, it's a shame you haven't, and actually it's a shame that there aren't a lot more such systems in the world. That is a technology called personal rapid transit, and it's something that people have been trying to build since the 1960s. So the first system, which was anything like that, was developed in Okinawa, Japan in, I think, 1968. They built this system of pods. The computers on each pod weighed about 1,000 pounds at the time. So, you know, it was much more right. Primitive. But it worked. And then they failed to commercialize it. And then the Germans did it in the early 70s with a system called cabin taxi. They built a test track, again, like the Japanese. And they failed to commercialize it. And the Americans had to go in the 80s, built a test track in Massachusetts, I think, and again failed to commercialize it. And I got interested in this technology because it had a lot of really compelling attributes. So keep in mind, this is from the days before anybody was talking about autonomous cars.
Right.
So the problem of putting autonomous cars on the road is hugely complex because roads are extremely chaotic environments. Doing visual navigation around pedestrians and cyclists and the just tremendous variety of terrains that cars are driven through is a computational problem that we still haven't really solved. But back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, we're nowhere near solving. But if you put a vehicle in an environment which is basically deterministic, you know exactly what the track looks like, you know that there aren't going to be any other classes of vehicles or users of that track, then suddenly the computational abilities to navigate this become a lot easier. You can do it with technology that's decades old. And you basically get the benefits of driverless cars, without without all the complexity of the AIs that we're developing today. Now, of course, this comes at a cost. You have to build infrastructure for this. These things run on elevated guideways, or they could run underground as well. But the important part is that they don't interact with other cars on the road. And that makes it actually very fast. In fact, faster than a bus, faster than a train, faster than a car, because it's not stopping at stoplights either. Everything is synchronized together, so there's no slowdowns.
And they hit 25 miles an hour or something.
They do at Heathrow, yeah. And so I saw this technology, and people had been trying to develop this technology for decades, always failing, but it seemed to combine the best of both worlds. It's a form of public transport that gives you the benefits of a private car in many respects. It also would use much less energy than a car or a bus or a train outside of peak hour trains when you have a very high number of passengers on board. I was fascinated. For some reason, it had never successfully been commercialized. So I quit architecture, got an MBA studying kind of innovation theory to try and understand what the obstacles to developing this technology had been. And then I joined the company that was developing the Heathrow pod. So they were just finishing development of the pod system at Heathrow when I joined. And by that point, I had been studying these pod systems as a concept for about 8 years, but I'd never actually ridden on one. And I have to say, the first time that I rode on this thing at Heathrow, it was amazing, because for about the first 20 seconds, I was like, wow, it's driving itself. It's switching through junctions on its own. This is amazing. This is totally like something out of the Jetsons. And then after about 20 seconds, it became completely normal. And I just had a conversation with the other people in the car, and the scenery went by, and it was just the most normal thing in the world. Anyhow, so we built the system at Heathrow. It does work there brilliantly. The average waiting time for a passenger is about 13 seconds. It's carried millions of people at this point with no safety incidents at all. But it hasn't been expanded, and nothing else like it has been built in the world.
I should just preface my next question by just informing everyone that you also set up another business in the past called Futurescaper, where you provide crowdsourced engagement for horizon scanning, foresight, and strategic intelligence. So effectively, you're using the power of human collected thought to predict future trends.
That's correct, yeah.
And you have clients including the UN, amongst others.
Yeah.
So given your backgrounds and the fact you have a futurescaping business, who better to tell me what the hell the future is for transport and the way we will travel around in 10 years' time?
So from any given point, there are always multiple possible futures. And what we try and do with Futurescaper is use the collective intelligence process to map out the range of possible futures, not to predict which one is the most likely, but actually to make people aware of what that range could be so that they can develop strategies that are either robust enough to survive in very qualitatively different futures or agile enough to pivot rapidly if they end up in a future that is different than what they expected. So what is the future going to be? I can't. Professionally, I cannot say that it is going to be this. Personally, I have a strong belief that the transport system of the future is probably going to be your feet.
Wow. Really?
Yeah.
That's so disappointing.
No, I like it. People like walking around. And the trend is towards increasing sort of human contact. The industries that you see really surviving into the future as human-powered industries rather than things that are automated are industries that are built around social connections, around webs of trust and so forth. I would include finance, for mm-hmm. example, is very much a trust-based industry. And trust is something that, that can't be commoditized. So, you know, trust is something like if it's just based on information and information is a commodity, then, you know, what creates excessive levels of trust is actually like looking people in the eye. It's going out drinking with them and golfing or whatever. Like, and it's something that is intrinsically human contact based. And so what we're seeing is actually people are valuing those human connections, which require, you know, trust. Creativity is another one, you know, software companies, theoretically you can work from anywhere. Yep. In practice, the conversations that you have at the pub are vital.
Right.
And so, you know, those creative and social and trust-based industries are becoming more and more important. And I just don't see that stopping anytime soon.
You will still need to get around the city, but you just think that the traditional methods of tube, walking, cycling will...
I think they'll continue. Okay. I think they'll continue, and I think that autonomous vehicles will actually augment that if they're factored in the correct way. A lot of what people expect to see from driverless cars, they will not. So some of the expected benefits, for example, are that you'll be able to get around the city faster.
Yeah.
Because the cars will all synchronize
at the same time, yeah.
their operations together. This won't happen.
Sorry.
They will. What will happen is that they will be synchronized together, and so certain types of congestion will not occur. So when you have human drivers, most congestion occurs because we're bad at driving. You get what's called standing wave congestion, where
you're tempting the queue at the lights. You are starting to move whatever 20 seconds after the first guy. So
right, and with the vision for autonomous transport is that all those cars can accelerate off the light simultaneously.
Right.
This actually doesn't quite work though, because as they accelerate, they also need to spread out. So you can't have autonomous vehicles following each other at centimeters distances. That's actually unsafe because they will blow tires. They will
Yep.
they will, you know, have things which cause them to slow down or stop. So you need a distance between them, such that the trailing vehicle can detect a failure in the leading vehicle and can decelerate at their maximum emergency braking speed in such a way that they won't hit the leading vehicle if the leading vehicle is decelerating at its maximum failure rate.
Yep.
And so what this means is you have this gap between vehicles that is necessary to prevent collisions. And that gap grows according to the square of the speed. So the faster the vehicles are going, you know, if the vehicles are going twice as fast,
yep.
that gap needs to be four times as large. And this is just physics. Automation doesn't change this. What automation changes is the reaction time. So in humans, the reaction time to seeing that a vehicle has failed in front of you is about 1 second. In automated vehicles, the reaction time would be milliseconds, which is great. But all you've done is save about a second. Hmm. Apart from that, you don't get a gain. So for the case of driverless cars accelerating off of
yeah.
a light, the lead vehicle can accelerate at their maximum possible acceleration, but each vehicle behind them needs to accelerate slower and slower and slower in order to spread out as they reach speed. So you will get faster movement off the light, but not as dramatically
okay.
as people expect, right?
Yeah.
So that goes away. That will help with congestion, so things will get smoother, right? But they won't necessarily get faster. And the reason for this is when you put more cars on the road, when they're human-driven, you get these standing wave things. When you put more cars on the road that are machine-driven, what happens is they will smoothly slow down in order to accommodate more capacity on the road. So that gap, that safety gap that you need to have between cars, the slower you go, the shorter that gets. It gets exponentially shorter, right?
Yep.
Meaning that the best way to add capacity to the road is to slow things down. You actually optimize capacity on roads at around 13 to 16 miles per hour. And autonomous cars will be very good at doing this. So what you'll get is, rather than a start-stop-start-stop where you're averaging 16 miles per hour, but your max speed is much higher, what you'll get with autonomous cars is you'll just get 13 miles per hour, but not start-stop-start-stop. So sorry to burst your bubble.
Yeah,
there.
You've killed a lot of dreams.
It gets a bit worse.
Oh no.
So one of the major gains that people expect from autonomous cars is to be able to get rid of car parks.
Yeah.
Which would be great. Car parks use a huge amount of space in cities. Right. It's excellent to get rid of them.
And parking, roadside parking as well.
Yeah. And actually, you know, cars spend 95% of their lifetimes parked, providing any value.
Mine spends even more than that.
That is stupid. You know, that's really stupid. Like, it would obviously be so much better if you had 10 times fewer cars in the city, and they could just stay continually in service, picking people up and dropping people off, right? And that's the sort of mobility as a future, or mobility as a service future that a lot of people are talking about.
Go on, kill this dream.
No, it's a great dream, actually. There's a lot of benefits to removing parking from cars and having 10 times fewer cars in circulation. It just means there will be more cars actually on the road.
Oh, yeah.
Because at any given moment, about 30% of those cars will be completely empty, just shuttling around so that they can get from where the demand was to where the demand is going to be. So the empty vehicle repositioning is not something that currently exists, but something that becomes very, very important when you have fleets of driverless cars trying to provide service to a city.
So for anyone listening who needs to plan a transport project, how do they get in touch?
Well, go to www.podaris.com and get in touch there. I have lots of means to do so.
And we finish up with two slightly random questions. The first of which is, what is your favorite building?
My favorite building is the Pantheon in Rome.
It's amazing how many people go for the classics. Yeah, I think I probably would as well. But
honestly, when I was a fresh architecture student, or just out of architecture school, I did the inevitable pilgrimage to Rome and spent a full day sitting in the Pantheon and watching from the first moment that beam of light comes through the oculus and starts making its way down the side of the dome, and as the space fills up with people, the beam of light starts becoming solid, and that's the breath of all the people in the space catching the light from the sun and making it into this solid looking beam. It's unbelievable from an aesthetic point of view, from an engineering point of view, from every single point of view that I as an architect can imagine. I don't think it's ever been topped.
That is by far and away the most poetic explanation we've had for a favorite building, so thank you for that. And finally, Podaris aside, what technology or innovation out there at the moment in the real estate field kind of excites you or interests you?
Well, actually, so I was listening to your podcast earlier, and one thing that you'd featured previously was a cross-laminate timber, which I'm tremendously excited by. I think the possibility of building skyscrapers out of carbon-negative materials that are, frankly, quite beautiful is amazing. And so I think there's a lot of great opportunities for city building coming out of material innovation. I think that when we start getting into computational fabrication of buildings, in a way it can be like going back to the expertise that the guilds provided, that the gap between the design of the building and the construction of the building can be closed again. So when the designer has the power to, you know, hit the print button on a building and get a building, that's going to give designers a lot more flexibility.
Yeah, creative flexibility.
Yeah, creative flexibility. And also a lot more responsibility.
Right.
Right now, frankly, a lot of designers don't know what they're doing either. and sort of offload that lack of knowledge onto laborers who hopefully do know what they're doing. So, but when you close that gap, when you make the design and the production essentially part of the same process, I think the quality of buildings can improve. So I'm excited by that future.
A very reasonable thing to be excited about. Well, look, thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure chatting through all sorts of things with you. But you've crushed a few dreams of a transportation future in the process.
Pleasure, anytime.
Thank you. Nathan is a font of knowledge on all sorts of things that I know very little about, and it's fascinating to hear his views on such a wide range of topics. While infrastructure planning and collaboration may appear fairly niche, if you think about it, it's something that has a direct impact on all of us. It's hard for us to think seriously about things like Crossrail 2 and HS2 when the timeframes seem so distant. If Podaris can help bring these projects into nearer time realities, then it's a technology I can get 100% behind. This kind of collaboration surely also has practical usages across a range of smaller projects requiring multiple stakeholders too. I hope Nathan's thoughts on transport and autonomous vehicles have got you thinking. It's certainly challenged some of my hopes and preconceptions of the idea. Not only is it clearly infinitely more complex than I'd appreciated, but the tangible benefits of AVs may also be less apparent. It's certainly something to reflect on. It's interesting that Nathan, like Chris Choa, Andrew Waugh, and Vanessa Burtz in previous interviews, has returned to the idea of human connectivity in transport. In a world of increasing urbanisation and digital connectivity, the way we live and work are clearly changing. But we need to think about this in our transport planning too. The ways in which we travel and the reasons for doing it are likely to change. And we need to keep human needs at the heart of what we're planning, making sure that we change our infrastructure, our transport infrastructure, in a manner in which best matches our needs rather than simply just trying to push the limits of our technological abilities. Thank you again for listening. And please, as ever, do mention a podcast to a friend or colleague. Word of mouth really is my best friend in this. Otherwise, I shall look forward to joining you in due course. Thanks again.